Hello, this is Mark Peacock, and welcome to the Travel Commons Podcast. This is Travel Commons Podcast number 124, recorded Thursday, September 28th, 2016. This is the podcast giving the voice of the traveler. It's more about the journey than the destination. Two topics on this edition of the Travel Commons Podcast: craft beer hunting and I Hate Rick Steves. So coming to you today from the mobile Travel Commons studio, actually the Sheraton Framingham Hotel and Conference Center in Framingham, Massachusetts, on the road. Don't know, you might be able to pick up a little bit of the traffic noise from Massachusetts 9 running outside the window. We affectionately call this hotel the castle, because when you're driving down 9, that's what it looks like, is a big castle. So I've been back on the road almost immediately since I got back to Scotland. I had about 10 kind of mostly beautiful sunny days in Scotland, and then have been kind of bouncing between Baltimore and now today up to Boston. But you know, the Scotland trip, which I mentioned in the last episode, flew United to Edinburgh via Newark on the way out. But on the way back, I paid kind of the extra $200 for the luxury of skipping the immigration lines at Newark. And I got to tell you, given my weekly experiences at Newark's Terminal A at the beginning of this year, and I talked about them in some previous episodes, I just can only imagine the immigration hall as being some sort of a mashup of the dungeons from all the Saw movies, done over in that sort of, you know, in a frighteningly absurd sort of way that only the TSA, I think, can really pull off. You know, think about the LAX security lines without laid-back people, kind of with that Jersey edge. I mean, even with the global entry line cut, that was not the final memory I wanted from what had been a very nice trip. My wife and I kind of ran the same play we did last year when we dropped our daughter off at University of St. Andrews. We grabbed a car. Hertz gave us a very nice Nissan Xterra. Nice car, enough space for the bags my daughter had brought over with her. But later on, it would be sort of this lumbering beast among all these little Fiat 500s, like I said, later in the week when we were driving some single-lane roads in the Highlands. I like to think I'm getting better at driving in the UK, you know, driving on the left and shifting with the left hand. No curb bumping or wide left-hand turns this time coming out of the airport. We stopped off at our mall. There's this mall, the Guile, that's about 5 minutes from the airport, from Edinburgh Airport. We stopped off there for Starbucks coffee and a couple of EE SIM cards. It was about £15 for 2 gig of data, unlimited text, and, I don't know, something like 500 voice minutes, which for a week is pretty much unlimited. That ended up being $20 at the current post-Brexit bargain basement exchange rate, so it was a phenomenal deal. Compare that to $60 for 300 megabytes of data that AT&T wants for international. Well, after lunch and unloading our daughter, my wife and I drove up the coast for a few days of walking. Not hiking with packs and crampons, but trail walking, rambling, as they like to say in the UK. We stayed the weekend in Aberdeen because, I don't know, we'd never been there before. It was a nice town. We went out to the Brewdog Brewery for a tour and a couple of beers, and then walked those beers off along a North Sea trail. We also spent some time in Cairngorms National Park on Balmoral Estate, getting blown out of our jackets by gale force winds while looking for the Queen and her Range Rover, and then went straight up north the coast along Banff, Portsoy, Cullen for a bit more coastal trail walking. And then back down to St. Andrews for the last couple of days, doing the typical stuff parents do when they visit their kids at college: take them out to nice restaurants, buy them groceries, and in our case, say goodbye until Christmas break. Flying out of Edinburgh Airport on Saturday morning was surprisingly not a hassle. It's not a huge airport, and mostly seems to be budget airlines, Ryanair, EasyJet. But United and American fly a couple of 757s in, United from Newark and O'Hare, American from JFK. I also saw an Etihad 787, which made me incredibly jealous. Now, at Edinburgh, the ticketing and check-in areas are a bit of a cluster. I mean, it really gives a bad first impression of that airport. And it's kind of in the basement, low ceilings, lousy signage, just bad. But once you get up the escalator and headed towards security, it just sort of all opens up. So it's really much nicer. And there was a low hassle pass through security, and then good shops and restaurants. And so really, really, once you get past that, once you get past check-in, it's really nice. It always strikes me how much more automated some of the European airports have become. Now, in Edinburgh, there's no security person checking your ticket before you get into the security queue. Instead, there's a gate and a barcode reader. You scan your boarding pass. If it's valid, the gate drops and you walk through. Now, there are security people kind of watching for gate jumpers and tailgaters, but there's like about a half dozen automated gates for a couple of security people. So there's really no queue, again, unlike in the US. And then at the X-ray machines, there's no sort of TSA-like person bringing tubs to the front of the line. Instead, a person points you to one of five kind of loading stations. A conveyor system spits out a bin, you load it up, push it back onto the belt, and that feeds the X-ray machine. Again, less waiting because instead of a single person loading their tub and putting their stuff on the belt, you've got five folks in parallel doing this. So if one person is slow or doesn't quite have their act together, it doesn't hold up the other line and they don't get the death stare from everybody else. I don't know, not quite sure why the TSA, with all its budget and management staff, can't just go and copy this. Hey, so following up, not to turn this into a complete Caledonian podcast, but I did have a few aha moments during this trip to Scotland. First, the spread of contactless card readers at stores in the UK has spread the acceptance of Android and Apple Pay, which means that not having a chip and PIN card is much less painful. Remember, the US cards are chip and signature because, I don't know, I guess we can't be trusted to remember 2 4-digit codes. And with those cards in the past, if you try to go up to, say, a self-service counter like at a gas station or say like a go to the self-service lines at say like a grocery store like Tesco, it used to be okay, maybe not painful, but at least a bit embarrassing to have to wait for the self-service attendant to come up, find me, look at me a bit confused as she gave me a receipt and, kind of search for a pen for it to be signed. Now, I gotta tell you, the Apple Pay is even faster than a chip and PIN card. I just sort of tap the phone on the card reader, beep, and it's done, and I'm on my way. If they would just kind of upgrade the little mobile credit card readers that waiters bring to your table in European restaurants, so I could go beep with those, then I'd be done. I've found, and this has been through all my travels in Europe this year, it's really tough to find a good cup of brewed black coffee. Now, I don't know, call me a redneck Midwesterner, but there are times that I don't want foam milk, I don't want just like a little swig of coffee that is espresso, and I certainly don't want that little swig of coffee diluted with hot water. I just want a cup of black coffee, filter coffee, as I've learned to call it, as I've learned to order it. It's damn close to impossible to find in Spain and Portugal, and quite honestly, in a lot of places in the UK, except at Starbucks. Now, everybody can rail about international and the American brands taking over the world, but I got to tell you, there have been many European mornings after many European late nights that I have thanked God and Howard Schultz for Starbucks' aggressive international expansion. Call me selfish. So on this trip, I was surprised, thrilled, really kind of ecstatic to find an actual Portlandia-like coffee pour-over place, complete with Chemexes and Hario kettles in Aberdeen on a Saturday morning. Place is called Food Story Cafe. It was about, I don't know, like a 7-minute walk from our hotel, and it was sort of back behind on a secondary street. How did I find it? by Googling hipster Aberdeen. Yes, that was my actual Google search term. I know it's silly and I know it's kind of absurd, but it actually works. I've used that search term in many cities. Hipster Madrid, hipster Lisbon, and more times than not, I have been very happy with the results. And Food Story Cafe, it was absolutely true to the billing. If I had looked at the image search for hipster Aberdeen, a picture of Food Story Cafe should have been the first hit. Now, our hotel in Aberdeen was nice, except for one thing. The tub had one of those little half-wall tub screens instead of a shower curtain. There should be a YouTube video on how to shower in those things, because every time I try, I hose down the sink and absolutely everything in it. I don't know, maybe I'm too large. I'd like to think not. But I don't know, why this little wall instead of a shower curtain? I just don't get it. Sitting in a restaurant our last night in St. Andrews, again, like I said, doing what parents do to college kids, give them a very nice final meal before they're off on their own. Our waitress there, a very nice person who was giving us very good service, had just a hint of a Eastern European accent. I wanted to ask her where she's from, but I don't know, in this sort of post-Brexit Britain, it felt kind of rude to ask that question. I'm not trying to make a snarky comment about the results of the Brexit vote. Look, I mean, even though I don't think I would have voted Brexit, but look, the tough thing about democracy is that everyone's vote counts, and that every vote needs to be respected, not just the ones that you agree with. And I think, we're coming to that issue here in the U.S. coming into November. There's got to be mutual respect. So again, I'm not trying to be snarky about, this isn't a comment about the Brexit vote, but it just, things have changed around immigration, and it feels different, just a bit. Now back in the U.S., I continue to struggle with my tendency to bitch tweet. On one flight, I was able to hold back during sort of this 20-minute wait for a gate on United. Typical, like, hey, we land early. Hey, it's going to be a 15-minute wait for a gate. I have to say I did provide some frank feedback on the customer survey that they sent me a couple of days later. But the next week, on my third straight delayed United flight, I don't know, I just couldn't control myself. I understood when we had to return to the gate to manually start the remaining engine. I mean, jets often taxi out to the runway using just one engine in order to save fuel, I mean, which makes perfect sense. And United did a good job of finding us a gate, unlike the flight I just mentioned. They, and it's not an easy thing at rush hour and morning rush hour in O'Hare. And actually, the maintenance crew was pretty quick about getting there and starting the engine up. So that all went pretty well. Where I lost it, though, was when it took longer to download the updated data to the plane computer than it took to return to the gate and manually start the engine. I was just boiling over just at the absurdity of the situation. Now, to the pilot's credit, he did a good job of explaining the situation, kept us regularly statused, and most importantly, at the end of the flight when everybody's deplaning, he didn't hide in the cab and let the flight attendants take all the stick. He was there. He had the cockpit door open, and he was standing there saying hi to everybody. So good for the pilot. Lousy for United that they made me bitch tweet. Bad United. Now, Mark Lowald, a longtime Travel Comments listener, sent me a note along these same lines asking me, would you consider this gentleman, and he sent me a picture of a guy, solving his problems with Verizon over the speakerphone in an otherwise empty and peaceful lounge in JFK worth bitch tweeting? And the picture was this guy sitting alone with his luggage and amongst probably a couple dozen chairs and two or three empty booths. It struck me. I mean, Mark has now brought bitch tweeting to a whole new level with bitch subtweeting. And you could just see it, right? This guy, walks in, feels like this JFK lounge is his own personal office, and now just starts conducting work over a speakerphone because, of course, it is just entirely too difficult to hold the phone to your ear or plug in, a headset. It was just, I just had to laugh. But I just was thinking to me, man, bitch subtweeting. I should have done that with the guy behind me on my last BWI to O'Hare flight, who had his feet up on the back of my seat for the entire flight. And this was not a kid. This was a guy in his mid-50s. I just thought to myself as I read Mark's note, I was like, this, I should have done it. This is the next level of bitch tweeting. Over the past couple of episodes, actually, maybe even over the past year, we've been talking about security, first physical security, and then a lot around cybersecurity, and you know, doing the click down on cybersecurity, talking about VPNs, virtual private networks, as a way to improve your security when you travel. You know, VPNs encrypt your network traffic, which is always a good thing over, say, public or hotel Wi-Fi, and then but will also tunnel your traffic through the internet, making it look like you're accessing the internet from wherever the VPN endpoint is. Now, for corporate users, that makes you look like you're accessing the internet from your office, allowing you to use, you know, systems inside your corporate firewall. And for international travelers, I mean, it's a way to get around, say, you know, the Great Firewall of China. But it also gives you a way to watch, say, you know, TV shows that are licensed to Netflix in the U.S., but not in other countries. Now, all the VPN products that I've used have been software-based. Now, my company uses a Cisco VPN, and then on this last trip to China, I used ExpressVPN. A company called Homing Systems used Kickstarter to launch a hardware-based VPN product called Always Home, and I think that name is a good one. They sent me a sample to try out. It's a pair of USB dongles. You connect one to your home router. I've got it plugged into my UVerse modem router thing in the basement. And then you have the second one, and that one sort of travels with you. So you could have it connected to your laptop, or in this case, when I was testing it in Scotland, I plugged the second dongle into the BT router, into the British Telecom router that's in my daughter's flat in St. Andrews. After you plug it in, there's a bunch of light blinking, and eventually the two dongles sync up. And then it looks like if you know when you associate with that second dongle, looks like you're popping up. You know, through my UVerse box outside of Chicago. So my daughter fired up her Netflix account and was able to continue her Criminal Minds watching binge, a show that's not on the UK Netflix, without any problem. Fine performance, video didn't stutter. In earlier testing, I found Always Home was a bit more fiddly when it needed to connect first through a password portal, kind of the typical setup at, say, like a hotel. I mean, it would connect, but it took a bit more work. Now, like I said, when the Always Home connection nails up, though, the performance was solid. Homing Systems' website labels their product or calls their service space shifting. And I think that's the right positioning. I think it's quicker to fire up a software VPN client for a quick session, say at a Starbucks. I think the Always Home dongle setup seems more suited for more sustained session, like watching Netflix. Check out the show notes for links to Homing Systems if you're interested. Hey, and if you've got any thoughts, questions, a story, a comment, a travel tip, the voice of the traveler, send it along. Mark Lowald sent his bitch-tweeting question to the email address, comments, comments, at travelcommons.com. You can always use your smartphone to record and send in an audio comment. A lot of you guys hit me on Twitter at mpeacock. You can post your thoughts on the Travel Commons Facebook page, or, as always, you can post your thoughts at the website at travelcommons.com. First topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is craft beer hunting. Special guest is my craft beer hunting partner, Andrew Peacock, my son.
I am Andrew Peacock, and I have been to a fair amount of countries with my father just sort of looking for craft beer, and then sometimes on purpose and sometimes sort of just accidentally falling into it and realizing, oh wow, this country has a much larger craft beer population than sort of you'd initially think. So some places are well known for beer, and then others are just much more surprising that there's actually a focus on beer at all.
So we think about where we've done this craft beer hunt, right, a bit. You know, we think about some of the countries. We think about Holland, China, Portugal, Iceland, Japan. I don't know, am I missing anything?
Brussels started off, which is like a quintessential beer country, right? So you think, oh yeah, I want to go drink beer. Let's go to Belgium.
Well, you know, that was, I mean, if you think about it, we landed in Brussels. We got off the plane, we dropped the bags in the Marriott, and then immediately walked down to Cantillon Brewery. I mean, that was the start, right? You walk down Cantillon and literally, like, you know, €6 ahead, they gave you a piece of paper, said, you know, walk through the place and don't break anything.
Yeah, and so, I mean, that's just such a quintessential beer place. You rolled out of Cantillon and then sort of proceeded to spend 5 days just stumbling from bar to bar. And so there are so many beer bars there in comparison to somewhere like Portugal or Japan or even China, where craft beer is just sort of a very fledgling thing.
Although, you know, you think about, I mean, China was kind of interesting, like when we were walking through that Hutong and just kind of rounded the corner and boom, there was Great Wall Brewing. And it was just like, look, people living, people like hanging out laundry, here's a bicycle, here's something off the side of the road. And then boom, there was a microbrewery.
It's a common thing because the other sort of well-known or big one there is Slovo Brewing, which is also in a hutong, actually.
Oh.
And on the door it says, please respect our neighbors, we're in a hutong, this is a residential area, please don't be loud outside. So the locations of those two were pretty interesting, sort of out of the way from everything and not destination locations.
Well, I think that's the interesting thing, is that kind of that hunt for a beer place takes you outside of the travel bubble. It takes you outside of the tourist bubble. Into some places that you wouldn't normally go. I mean, we wouldn't have normally wandered down that hutong. There was absolutely no reason to go wandering down that hutong in Beijing, except there was Great Wall Brewing.
There's a beer at the end of the
there's a beer at the end of the tunnel.
I mean, there's a similar thing with Japan too. Like, yeah. Just all these places are just tucked in and sort of out of the way and in these residential areas. Really, it's. They're more like residential bars than like these big, like popular places to go in a tourist area. So it really just sort of gets you out and into some more interesting parts of a country that you'd never go to before. And then sort of as a plus, you find beer as well.
Well, I mean, Japan, when we were in Osaka and we ended up wandering around and we were like popping, you know, a couple of bar, we end up going into this little bar, you know, sitting down. The beer was okay. The beer wasn't great, but we ended up talking to this guy. And I mean, his English was pretty good. And that was the thing about Japan is sometimes English, I mean, it was real spotty on the English. And his was okay. And he really wanted to have that conversation. We just started talking about beer.
Yeah, and then just sort of hanging out, drinking, and then a few days later running into him, like 2 hours by train away in Tokyo. It was just a really surreal experience. And then there's a picture of you and I sort of running around on Japanese fans' Facebook page at this point. So it's a good way to meet local people as well. So it gets you out of a tourist bubble. It'll get you interacting with local people and sort of talking about them because there's that shared interest and maybe their English isn't that great and it's a bit of a rough conversation, but you have a shared interest and you can sort of communicate through a common medium. So it's a good way to get out and to also meet some local people.
I think when we ended up in Portugal and we ended up going to that, now this wasn't a microbrewery, this was actually a craft beer bar, and you remember it was kind of up and away. Again, it wasn't an area that we were going to go into. It wasn't an area that there were a lot of tourists. This was in Lisbon. So Lisbon and Porto.
It was in Lisbon, and yeah. It was on a shopping mall strip, a pedestrian-only walking shopping mall strip, but not a tourist pedestrian-only right. Shopping.
And if you think about it, I mean, at that point in May, that was the thing. Both Lisbon and Porto were pretty heavily hammered with tourists.
Yeah, I mean, you had cruise ships coming into Lisbon. And
so the main drags were pretty heavily touristed. But when we went up to that place, that, you're right, there was a pedestrian shopping street, but it felt pretty local. I'd heard a lot of English and a lot of German. through in the downtown area of Lisbon. But when we got up to that section, it was just Portuguese that we were hearing. And then when we went tucking away, and that bar was even kind of, well, it was off that.
It was
What?
hard to find. If you
Yeah.
didn't know what you were looking for, and if you didn't go at the right time, you weren't finding it. So even when you're in there, it was a lot of Portuguese locals, like, oh, this is their sort of neighborhood bar. So that's what it is in a lot of places. It's just you're sort of invading someone's neighborhood bar. As opposed to that other bar we went to that was like right off the water where the tourists or where the cruise ships would dump people. And it's all tourists, everything's in English, and there's like maybe two beers you've never heard of before, and they're like local beers, but everything in there is big and catered to those tourists. So going to places that cater to locals as opposed to cater to tourists is always, at least in my opinion, a better vacation experience.
And I think that's what it is. When you the whole idea around I'm gonna hunt something down, I'm gonna look for it. It gives you a reason to get out of the standard tourist area, and it gives you a destination. So it gives you a reason to go someplace and a reason to go find someplace. And then, as you said, when you get there, you've got a topic of conversation that you can have with somebody. There is a shared interest. And even if the language is minimal, there's at least a shared vocabulary around beer styles and beer types. Now, when you think about it, how do you find that? I think the thing what we've found is very useful is the Untappd app.
Yeah, it's sort of the sole way to find where people actually are, because you can read plenty of top 10 these bars you must go to lists for a country, but like at that point those lists are sort of being curated for tourists, right? So in Portugal, I'll go back to that cruise ship bar example. That was one that was in a few guides, and it said, oh, you should go here, you should go there, because a lot of people go there. So it really depends on the guide and like what kind of tourism you're doing. But if you're into this, then going to an app that says, oh, hey, this is where all the local people are checking in, sort of gives you a better insight than a highly curated list of locations that someone else thinks will reach the lowest common denominator.
Well, also, it's real time. So if you think about it, you're able to see in real time where people are at, where people are, what people are drinking and where they're drinking. And as well as sort of like, here I am, what's within a 5 mile radius or what's within a 3 mile radius? So what can you walk to?
Yeah, that's the real-time updating, I think, is the greatest fit. I mean, you can see, oh, here's this shop, but are they just drinking a bunch of macro beers, or is there some small stuff that you haven't seen?
Well, that's it. Craft beer hunting. Where are we off to next?
It's a good question. There are a lot of places. Eastern Europe has a lot of promise. The Baltics.
Yeah, I think the Germany thing too, like, kind of do the Kolsch beer in Cologne and Alt beer in Dusseldorf. I think that's got potential.
Instead of going out of our way to find an interesting place, just sort of going right to the source to see what we can do there.
Go all old school. Go all old school. So the second topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is I hate Rick Steves. Now, not personally, of course. I'm sure he's a nice guy who doesn't kick his dogs, but I guess to be more precise, I hate what Rick Steves has done to some of my vacations. So Portugal is the most recent example. So preparing for our trip, my wife read a number of Lisbon travel guides, including Rick Steves. And in one section, Rick advises travelers to Lisbon to do a day trip out to Sintra, and this is this castle-filled UNESCO World Heritage site that's I don't know, maybe 30-minute train ride from Portugal. Rick advises those folks who are doing that day trip to do it on Monday when all the Lisbon museums are closed. So Monday morning, we get up early, go across the street for our standard breakfast of coffee and pastel de natas. These are egg custard tarts that are really to die for. And then we hit the train. It's standing room only. We get off the train in Sintra. All we see are older Americans with sensible haircuts, plastic-rimmed glasses, and hiking shoes. It's like we're walking through an NPR listener convention in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And they're all wearing their backpacks swung around in front to protect themselves from pickpockets and thieves, except that no local had any shot of penetrating the phalanx of blue book-wielding Steve heads. I mean, luckily for us, most of them followed Rick's advice to catch the bus to the top of the hill. We decided that we needed to work off those egg custard tarts, so we broke away from the Blue Book Brigade and walked up the road. Now, I don't begrudge Rick Steves his success. I mean, good for him. I mean, he seems to have worked hard for it. But his motto, Europe through the back door, it just can't apply anymore when he's got millions of readers trying to walk through that back door. I mean, that's not a back door anymore. That is like double door front. I mean, you know, kind of the same thing happened to Lonely Planet. We've noticed this one primarily when we go and travel in Asia. I mean, what was once kind of the hip backpacker's guide to cool, unique spots now leads people to mainstream tourism spots just by its recommendations because it's Amazon's best-selling, you know, travel guide series. Now, I think we successfully avoided the Steve-O's on this trip to Scotland. Aberdeen and the Northeast Highlands are nowhere to be found in Rick Steves' Scotland. And certainly the Food Story Cafe in hipster Aberdeen is nowhere. Certainly isn't there either. And I can't say that I actually heard too many North American accents on that part of our trip. We certainly did in St. Andrews, but not further up north in Aberdeen. I mean, save for the one day that we drove down to Dunnottar Castle. But, I mean, that's got to be one of the main tourist draws in that part of Scotland. And I think I heard almost as much German as I did American twang. I don't know. As it goes, I've tended more and more to use local Google searches rather than guidebooks. You know, Google often surfaces more local content. And, I don't know, limiting the results to the, you know, kind of the past year makes it a bit more current. But even this approach might not be backdoor enough. I have to tell you, back to my hipster Google search term, the barista at Food Story Cafe did mention that he's been seeing a surprising number of Americans recently. I don't know. I'm afraid, but I'm wondering if my hipster search strategy has become mainstream. Okay, that's it. That's the end of Travel Commons podcast number 124. I hope you all enjoyed the show, and I hope you decide to stay subscribed. Check out the show notes for music links, and you can find us on SoundCloud, Stitcher, iTunes. Although, if you're listening to this, I guess you've already found us, so you don't necessarily need that pointer. Yeah, there you go. Go figure. I don't know. Tell your friends. Tell your colleagues. Tell your loved ones about SoundCloud, about finding us on SoundCloud, Stitcher, and iTunes. Hey, as always, if you have a story, thought, comment, gripe, the voice of the traveler, send them along, text or audio file to comment, COMMENTS at travelcommons.com, or to mpeacock on Twitter, write them on the Facebook wall under Travel Commons, or post them on the website at travelcommons.com. Thanks to everyone who has taken the time to send in emails, tweets, post comments on the website. And so from the lovely Sheraton Framingham Hotel and Conference Center, remember, and Conference Center, I bid you adieu. have a good weekend, and thanks for stopping by the Travel Commons. Take care. Bye now.